Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Professor Alexander Nemirov for Outlandish Life, Peter Paul Rubens and the Baroque, exploring the dramatic art of the 17th century. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
Enemies. And now it seems that it's Adam Schiff's turn in the barrel.
I think in the same way that Donald Trump picks his cabinet by watching Fox, he picks his enemies by seeing who's effective against him on TV. That's the best I can do for why he seems to have a particular fixation, animosity towards me. By the way, it is very much shared.
Today on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Senator Adam Schiff and why Trump just can't quit him.
He spends an inordinate amount of time thinking about me. I live rent-free in that guy's head, and let me tell you, it's pretty scary in there.
We'll also talk with director Chloe Zhao about Hamnet, her new movie about a young William Shakespeare, not in love, but in grief. That's all ahead today on the New Yorker Radio Hour, right after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Border czar Tom Homan said today he doesn't know what President Trump was thinking when he said he wants Somalis out of the country. The president had called them garbage, but Homan said he agrees 100% with Trump's efforts to target Somali immigrants in Minnesota. He said the Trump administration is concentrating on public safety and national security threats.
We also know there's a large illegal Somali community there. There's illegal alien community, large illegal alien community there. You know, if you're a U.S. citizen, you know, you have nothing to fear. We're looking for criminal aliens. And also, if you're a resident alien, you have a, you know, like a felony conviction by statute, you could be set up for deportation. So we're looking for public safety threats, national security threats, and illegal aliens.
Homan was interviewed on CNN. A deal between the U.S. and the United Kingdom would spare the U.K.'s drug exports from hefty Trump tariffs for at least 3 years in exchange for more investment in the U.S. and creating more jobs. NPR's Sydney Lupkin reports.
New drugs typically cost a lot more in the U.S. than they do in other countries. And the Trump administration has been announcing deals with drug companies to try to even the playing field. Now the U.S. has a deal with another country, the U.K. The U.K. will increase the prices its health service pays for new medicines by 25% and will reduce rebates paid by drug makers. That's according to the Office of the United States Trade Representative. In exchange, U.K. drugs, drug ingredients, and medical technology will be exempt from U.S. tariffs for at least 3 years. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
The government of Benin says it's foiled an attempted coup. Soldiers had appeared on state television today and announced they'd deposed the president and taken over the country. It's the latest of several attempted coups in West Africa in recent years. NPR's Emmanuel Okinwutu reports.
The soldiers took over the state broadcaster and announced in a live address they had deposed President Patrice Talon. Gunshots were heard near the president's residence in the capital, Port Novo. But later on Sunday, the interior minister announced they had regained control, and a government spokesperson told the AFP news agency that the president was safe. Talon has been in power since 2016 and was due to step down next April after elections. He has faced accusations of authoritarianism, but attempted military coups in the region have grown common, and last year, Benin's government said it had arrested multiple officials for planning a takeover. Emmanuel Akinwutu, NPR News, Lagos.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said today he expects negotiations will move forward soon on the next stage of a ceasefire agreement with Hamas in Gaza. Netanyahu also said that if he is granted a presidential pardon on corruption charges, he would not withdraw from political life. This is NPR News in Washington.
Live from KQED News in Oakland, I'm Dana Cronin. A social worker who was stabbed at Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital earlier this week has died of their injuries. The City Department of Public Health confirmed the news in a statement yesterday. Police have arrested 34-year-old Wilfredo Tortolero Ariechi of San Francisco. Tortolero Ariechi has been charged with attempted murder, among other offenses. On the day of the incident, the San Francisco Sheriff's Office had been providing security for a doctor at the hospital who had received threats from a patient. The San Francisco Chronicle reported that hospital staff had raised safety concerns about the patient for weeks. The Department of Public Health has not identified the victim. Labor organizers are gathering signatures for a San Francisco ballot measure that would tax large corporations with highly paid CEOs in order to fund city services. KQED's Billy Cruz reports from a kickoff event yesterday.
Supporters say the measure would tax large corporations like Uber and Amazon, whose top executives make more than 100 times the median salary of their workers. State Assembly member Matt Haney says this measure will help alleviate expected cuts from President Trump's big, beautiful bill and support public hospitals and mental health programs.
The least we can do is ask these huge corporations, these billionaires who run them, to pay a little bit more themselves to make sure that when San Franciscans call, there's somebody on the other line to come in an emergency.
Proponents are aiming to get the measure on the city's June 2026 ballot. I'm Billy Cruz, KQED News.
And I'm Dana Cronin.
Support for NPR comes from StoryWorth. Each week, StoryWorth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, StoryWorth will publish their stories and color photos into a book to keep for generations. Learn more at StoryWorth.com. And support comes from the listeners like you of KQED News. 6 minutes after noon.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Donald Trump's enemies list is long and it's wide. Journalists, pop stars, late-night hosts, even his own architect, apparently, for the White House ballroom. And of course, Democrats, pretty much all of them at one time or another. But few public figures infuriate Donald Trump more than California Senator Adam Schiff.
I would just say Adam Schiff is one of the lowest forms of scum I've ever dealt with in politics. He's a horrible human being, very dishonest person.
The administration announced an investigation of Schiff for mortgage fraud not long ago. And now, confusingly, the Justice Department is investigating the handling of that investigation. So, what did Adam Schiff do to get that prominent place on the enemies list? When he was a congressman from a district around Los Angeles, Schiff was a leader of the first impeachment proceeding. You remember what that was. That was all about Trump's so-called perfect phone call with Ukrainian officials when he asked them to dig up dirt on Hunter Biden. And later, Adam Schiff was a member of the House committee that investigated the January 6th insurrection, and that inquiry brought much to light about Trump's role in those events. So Adam Schiff has been one of Trump's most persistent critics when it comes to the rule of law. And Trump, as a way of rewarding him, expresses his disdain by calling him pencil neck, watermelon head, and of course, shifty Schiff. For our purposes, we'll stick with Senator. The President of the United States seems to really dislike you.
Yeah.
Why?
He spends an inordinate amount of time thinking about me. I live rent-free in that guy's head, and let me tell you, it's pretty scary in there. I have a suspicion, which I hesitate to articulate because it's kind of a vain suspicion.
Please.
But I will share it anyway. During the Russia investigation, I'm deposing Jared Kushner. And it is just shortly after Trump has first attacked me on his Twitter account. Sleazy Adam Schiff, corrupt this, blah, 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 spends too much time on TV, pushing the hoax, something like that. And I remember the time being desperate to respond and being attacked by the president. At the time, a few months into Trump 1, that was very unusual for a president of the United States.
Unpleasant or flattering?
Well, my colleagues were all deeply jealous of me, but I was frantic to figure out how I was going to respond. This was going to tens of millions of people. I would soon learn, because it became quite routine, there was no way I could respond, at least not in a way that the people he was talking to would ever hear me respond. But nevertheless, I remember being on the House floor, and Mike Thompson, my colleague from Northern California, grabs my arm and he says, Adam, you should tweet back, Mr. President, when they go low, we go high, go f-
And I so wanted to do it. If I write a book one day of the tweets I wish I'd sent, that'll be on the cover. So I'm like a week later or 2 weeks later, I'm deposing Jared Kushner, the Russia investigation. And during one of the breaks, he comes up to me in an ingratiating way, in a calculated and ingratiating way. And he says, you know, you do a really good job on TV. And I said, well, thanks. Apparently your father-in-law doesn't think so. And he said, oh, yes, he does. And that's why. I think in the same way that Donald Trump picks his cabinet by watching Fox, he picks his enemies by seeing who's effective against him on TV.
Now, he loves you so much that he wrote on Truth Social to the Attorney General, Pam, I have reviewed over 30 statements and posts saying that essentially same old story as last time, all talk, no action, nothing is being done. What about Comey, Adam Shifty Schiff, Letitia, question mark, question mark, question mark. They're all guilty as hell, but nothing is going to be done. Now, Comey has been encountered, Letitia James as well. What's the status of this accusation against you? And I know it's there are limits to what you can and cannot
say.
But please do.
I can tell you what I know, which is frankly all I read in the paper.
Mm-hmm.
We've had no word from the Justice Department, no communication from them.
But it's coming like Christmas, no?
They're, I think, having a problem, at least as I read in the paper.
What's the supposed case?
The problem is they don't have a supposed case.
But spell out the accusation.
The accusation is a loose accusation of mortgage fraud, and they're making it against all their political opponents. I know that we've been completely open with my mortgage brokers, bankers, so there's no there. And they know it too. The question is, I think, are they going to fire everyone in Maryland so they can bring in another Lindsey Halligan like they did in Virginia? But we've seen how well that has gone in Virginia with both of the cases they brought against the other two Trump mentioned in that angry tweet, having their cases thrown out.
You seem rather serene about this.
To me, what I'm facing is this, frankly, the same fight I've been in since he became president the first time. In the beginning, it was a forward-leaning democracy-preserving effort to impeach a president who was abusing his power and then hold him accountable through the January 6th committee. This is the same fight, but now it is very much a defensive battle. And now he has new tools to abuse, including the Justice Department, but it is the same fight.
He talks a lot about Russia, 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 hoax, hoax, hoax. Did you get anything wrong about that?
No, I don't think we got anything wrong. I do think that at the end of the investigation, Mueller concluded, and I said, throughout the investigation.
Robert Mueller.
Mm-hmm. I said throughout the investigation, this was very possible, that he could not prove the crime of conspiracy beyond a reasonable doubt.
A lot of Democrats think there was, in the rearview mirror, some overreach, legal overreach, in the attempt to bring down Donald Trump. Do any of those cases seem like overreach or ill-advised in any way?
Well, certainly the federal cases, I would say no. The January 6th case, it's hard to imagine a bigger crime against the democracy than incitement of insurrection.
It wasn't a day of love, in your view.
It was. I was there. It was no day of love. Likewise, the president's not only bringing of hundreds of classified documents to his residence, but lying about it by obstructing the investigation into it, also very serious. In terms of the civil case, I will let Letitia James speak for herself on that case.
Seem a little dubious of it.
No, I wouldn't say that at all. But whether the same standard in that case was applied against Donald Trump as would have been applied against others, I will leave her to speak to. I just I wouldn't be able to compare what kind of cases I brought as a prosecutor in New York without knowing what kind of prosecutors cases I brought in New York. But I do think that the argument of some kind of equivalence is a false narrative. And I hear it all the time on the Senate Judiciary Committee. I hear all the time how the Justice Department under Merrick Garland, under that horrible partisan Merrick Garland, was so weaponized against Donald Trump. And that's a complete fiction and fabrication.
Do you feel that Merrick Garland moved too slowly, too cautiously?
I absolutely do, yeah. And this is the irony of it, of attacking Merrick Garland, which is they moved with alacrity against the foot soldiers who broke into the Capitol that day. They moved not at all for an entire year against the higher-ups.
Why did Merrick Garland move so slowly? What about his character or tactics or strategy led him to behave that way?
The Justice Department in the first Trump was abused and made partisan, and he wished to restore the department's reputation for independence. Now, what they did in the first Trump Justice Department is peanuts compared to today. But nevertheless, Merrick Garland wanted to restore the reputation of the department for strict nonpartisanship. And that made him very reluctant to pursue an investigation of the president. Too reluctant. Ultimately, that gave the Supreme Court the time it needed to drag things out further and make the case against Trump go away completely when it could have been brought to fruition. And we might be in a very different place today. But I think it was that laudable aim that, taken too far, amounted to a kind of immunity for the president.
I have to think that Donald Trump feels two things about the prosecutions against him and the impeachments. He feels that he prevailed, and that fills him with a sense of invulnerability at this point and rage at the same time. Do you agree with that, and how does that shape his behavior as president?
In his own head, it's often difficult to figure out, okay, what does the president really believe? Because I think what the president really believes is you make your own truth through repetition. So whether he's talked himself into his victimization, he's always viewed himself as a victim of everything. Whether he truly believes it, who really knows, is probably less important than what does he do on the basis of whatever belief he has. But I've also, you know, thought there's this interesting comparison of blind spots. Trump, being a pathological liar, can't envision anyone else committed to the truth. It's just an alien idea to him. It's a blind spot. Likewise, but from a completely opposite perspective, Bob Mueller, such a person of integrity and truth, that I think he found it impossible to believe that Bill Barr would so betray him, as Barr went on to do by misrepresenting Mueller's report. In a way, they have kind of an interesting but opposite blind spot, one unable to see people acting so unscrupulously because they're so they comport themselves with such integrity like Mueller, and the other like Trump, who has no moral compass and doesn't believe anyone else does either.
Do you think there's anything ruinous about the Epstein situation for Trump, or is this something that will fade like so many other things?
If there are ruinous things in the files, the public will never see them. Bondi and company will make sure they never reach the public eye. But for another, I think he's almost impervious to dirt.
I'm speaking with Senator Adam Schiff of California, and we'll continue in just a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. And by Progressive Insurance. Four walls and four tires protected. Customers can customize their insurance needs and protect what's important by bundling home and auto today. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE.
Support for KQED comes from Post Peninsula Open Space Trust. And Post has protected and cared for more than 93,000 acres of open space on the peninsula and in the South Bay for the benefit of all. Learn more at openspacetrust.org, openspacetrust.org. And support comes from European Sleepworks, the store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and bedding at sleepworks.com.
For decades, Alice Wong spoke of the need for disabled people to advocate loudly for their own health needs. It's been less than a month since Alice Wong's death, and I wanted to know who in her community is going to keep this fight going, this fight for disability justice. I'm Carlos Cabrera Lomelí, and I'm the community engagement reporter at KQED. You can find my story about Alice Wong's legacy tomorrow at kqed.org.
This week on the Sam Sanders Show, legendary costume designer Ruth E. Carter. From Malcolm X to Sinners, she built the look of Black Hollywood.
I see, you know, a young Black girl in there pulling for her show. I feel like I've had something to do with that. And I'm welcoming that.
Ruth E. Carter on costuming Sinners, Black Panther, and also Seinfeld.
The premiere of The Sam Sanders Show, 3 o'clock this afternoon, KQED.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick, and I'm speaking today with Democratic Senator Adam Schiff of California. Now, the headlines lately have been distinctly discouraging for President Trump. Disappointing economic numbers, lousy polling, and the departures of some MAGA faithful, including Marjorie Taylor Greene. And there's a sense now that Trump's grasp on Washington may be a little bit vulnerable. And yet the Democratic Party so far hasn't really capitalized on that sense or been able to seize the momentum. Adam Schiff has spent 25 years in Congress, serving in the House of Representatives before his recent election to the Senate. One thing I get tired of hearing, and this has been going on for years, Democrats saying, you know, my Republican colleagues in the halls of Congress allow to me, they admit to me that they can't stand Donald Trump, and then they don't act on it.
Yeah.
Why not? In other words, if you're, I ask a lot of people this, are these jobs so swell? Is it so great being a congressman or a senator that you don't want to risk going back to your home state or district and being a lawyer, a teacher, or whatever it was before, that you sell your principles and soul?
No, the job isn't worth it, and no job would be worth it. And at that level, I don't understand it at all. At a different level, I understand it completely. They're afraid. And I talked to one senator, for example, I, along with Tim Kaine, have been offering resolutions, war powers resolutions. So I was working the Republican senators. I know that a lot of them are deeply uncomfortable with this blowing up of ships and more uncomfortable with the idea of going to war in Venezuela. But I had one very senior Republican tell me, you have to understand, it's not just that he will punish us. He'll punish our whole state. So they're worried about their constituents, they're worried about themselves, they're worried about their personal safety. And then there is also this endless process of rationalization, which goes like this.
Somebody worse will come.
Yes. If I don't vote for RFK Jr., you should see the guy they've teed up to run against me in the primary. If I don't vote for Pete Hegseth, I would be primaried. I'd be gone. You should see who would come after me. My feeling is, let me see him. I mean, if you're going to just vote the same way anyway, how much worse could it be? I don't really derive any satisfaction from hearing private misgivings. I long since gained any solace from that. If you're going to vote with him on these things that are destroying the country, then why be here? And some of them are deciding, as you say, it's just not worth it to them anymore, and they are leaving the Congress.
In drips and drabs.
Yeah, yeah.
You raised Venezuela, and rightly so. The Senate and House have ordered investigations into whether Pete Hegseth ordered the killing of unarmed survivors in one of those boat strikes that's been going on in the Caribbean. I don't know how many have already taken place. The numbers are growing. Is there really actual bipartisan concern about these actions, and how much longer can they go on? What's coming down the road here?
There is bipartisan concern. We've had now two votes on war powers resolutions. We've had two Republicans who have voted to end the strikes or to withdraw any implied congressional approval of these things. We need four to be able to win in the Senate. We need, obviously, to carry the House, and we would need to do it by a veto-proof majority. Nevertheless, even in the absence of a veto-proof majority, it makes a statement. It has an impact. The president does pay attention when he's voted against by his own party. But up until now, the Republicans seem to take turns as to who can vote against the president. And
rarely allow that more than four people do so at one time. By and large, all we're seeing is verbal expressions of concern, occasional votes of concern. The Republicans who are now saying they're concerned about these reports that Hegseth ordered the murder of these survivors on one of these ships, I think does deeply concern them. The question is, will they go beyond concern? They both said they'll do an investigation in the House and Senate. So let's say this investigation reveals that, yes, they were survivors, and yes, they were killed.
Is that a war crime?
It would be a war crime. If those reports are accurate, it's a war crime. It's also murder. Will Republicans take the next step to hold anyone accountable? I'm very doubtful about that.
One of the great spectacles, and there's so many every day in political life, is the testimony and the committee hearings involving Kash Patel and your committee and Pam Bondi as well. The technique being employed by Kash Patel and Pam Bondi seems like something new. The way they don't answer your questions and then attack personally, whether it's you or anybody else on the committee.
Was that true, what the White House press secretary said when she denied home and took the money? Did he take the money?
Senator Schiff, I answered that question multiple times. And frankly, you know.
Well, I don't think, with respect, I don't think you did. But in case I just didn't hear you, what is the answer? Did he take the money?
Senator Schiff, that happened prior to my confirmation as
Attorney General. I understand, but do you know?
I said that.
Do you know sitting here whether
all
he took
I know
the money?
Is that Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche and FBI Director Patel said there was no case. And Caroline Leavitt is one of the most trustworthy human beings I know.
So
and
was she,
you know,
was
Senator
she,
Schiff,
was she
if
right?
you work for me,
she,
you would have been fired
well,
because you
me.
Were censured by Congress for lying with
we,
your
we can stipulate to You can stipulate to all your personal attacks on the Democratic members of the committee.
Personal attacks? You've been attacking my FBI director. You've been attacking my office.
But we're interested in.
Borders are.
What we're interested in is the answer to these oversight questions.
Want your,
so
no,
you were asked, you were asked by my colleague, you were asked by my colleague.
Attacking good people.
A regular order, Madam Chair, so I can ask a question.
If you watch Bondi in particular, it was so obvious because she kept turning to her notes for the pre-planned attack on Senator Blumenthal or Senator Whitehouse or Senator Schiff or whoever.
Does it work?
Well, it only works if the Republicans allow it to work. If the Republicans in that committee said, actually, We need to know, did Tom Homan, the White House border czar, allegedly take $50,000 from undercover FBI agents? And if he did, why was the case dismissed? And if it was he allowed to keep the money? I mean, pretty basic oversight question of a top-ranking Trump official.
And how do the Republicans respond?
With silence. And allowed Bondi to simply attack anybody asking that question. But it's also an illustration of who they're really speaking to in those hearings, which is an audience of one person. Pam Bondi knows the only person that she owes her job to is Donald Trump. The only one she needs to please is Donald Trump. So that's what Bondi does. And as long as she does that, she'll never have a problem in a hearing with her boss.
But does it matter that the institution involved is up in arms against its leader now? The FBI, for example, seems to be in its rank and file apoplectic about Kash Patel and Dan Bongino, that this leadership has made them furious in any number of ways. So does Kash Patel last?
I don't know if he lasts. If he doesn't last, it's because he keeps embarrassing the president. President doesn't care whether Kash Patel is competent. He does not like to be embarrassed, though. For Patel, for example, to say that the suspect was in custody after Charlie Kirk's horrible murder when it wasn't true because Patel wanted to leap out there on social media ahead of people and say things he knew nothing about, that is a humiliation for the president. And you can count on Patel to keep on embarrassing and humiliating the president because he's incompetent and in way over his head.
Who else would you put in that category of incompetence in the key cabinet positions?
Well, I don't know that I would put her in the category of competent, but willfully destructive, I would say Tulsi Gabbard. She does not get as much attention as the rest of these.
Well, it's hard to hear every voice in the choir.
Yes, it is. It's only an asterisk in articles now about Venezuela that the whole predicate of these attacks is a lie. That the intelligence community assessed that Tren de Aragua, this Venezuelan gang, was not being controlled by Maduro, by the government. They weren't sent to infiltrate America, carry out terrorist attacks or whatever. And so the National Intelligence Council writes this report. They speak truth to power. And they're told by Gabbard's chief of staff basically to rewrite their conclusion. And ultimately they're fired. Intel analysts know that if they write things that contradict the president's preferred narrative, they're gone.
Since it's the holiday season and we want to bring nothing but good cheer to our to our listeners, I must ask this. I know you'll say the fever will break step by step with things like the midterm elections, but we've had historians on and other political analysts who say, look, remember, this is not the first bad period of American history. We've had the Civil War, for God's sake. We've had all kinds of periods of enormous crisis and even existential feeling crises. Tell me what your greatest immediate fears are, and maybe go back to a little bit about how they can be avoided and tamped down and for us to get from month to month, year to year.
In the category of deepest fear, most profound concern, is that, you know, somehow they're successful in thwarting the one remaining mechanism for accountability, and that is the election. Barring that, their time will come to an end. But what we do right now will determine how quickly it passes, how much damage is done in the meantime, and making sure that we have a free and fair election has got to be at the top of our priority list, because the Supreme Court will not save us. Republicans in Congress will not save us, certainly not based on current conduct. And
will the coherence of the Democratic Party save us?
I think what will save us are the American people themselves. The most important players in our democracy are what is going to save this democracy. And that is the people with the title of citizen. And if you look at what the citizens are doing, gathering by the millions to protest the president, what the citizens just did in this last election in California, there were lines around the block to vote on a ballot measure about reapportionment? Seriously? Reapportionment? I mean, who would have thought five people would turn out to vote on reapportionment? But if anything, that election in California was the purest referendum on the president. In New Jersey and Virginia, in New York City, it was a competition of candidates. In California, there was no competition of candidates. It was simply a referendum on the president and his policies. And it drove people to the polls. So it's going to be the citizens that save us. We need to make sure that their votes still matter. The most successful tool that we've had has been litigation. We do very well in the lower courts, but even delaying harms is valuable when a country is marching towards a kind of dictatorship. The way I view my job every day, and I think this should be the same way that we all view our jobs, every day we need to think about what can I do today to mitigate the harms. I love how in Chicago, where they learned from the experience in Los Angeles, you have parents driving other parents' kids to school so that their parents don't risk being arrested and deported. I love how people are dropping off food to families so they don't have to risk going to the store. People are taking steps to support their neighbors, to support each other. These public servants who are getting fired or quitting are doing something really important to serve the country. And the federal employees who are staying on the job are doing something really important to save the country. There are just lots of people showing millions of acts of kindness, of devotion to our democracy, that give me the confidence to know we're going to get through this.
Adam Schiff, thank you.
Thanks, David. Great to be with you.
Senator Adam Schiff of California. He served in Congress since 2001. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Progressive Insurance. From the moment car insurance is quoted to the moment it's purchased, drivers can discover a variety of ways to stay protected. More at progressive.com. And by Maiden, makers of cookware found in restaurants around the world, offering a carbon steel griddle for home use, designed for cooking a range of foods, including eggs and fish. More at maidencookware.com.
Support for KQED comes from Berkeley Rep, presenting Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, a ghost story told by Jefferson Mays. A special one-week engagement through December 21st. More info at berkeleyrep.org. And San Francisco's Meta Fund, advancing health and equity and aging, reminding listeners that elders add value to communities every day. Learn more at mettafund.org.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, Padma Lakshmi, television host and cookbook author. She'll talk with comedian W. Kamau Bell about her newest book, Padma's All-American, Tales, Travels, and Recipes from Taste the Nation and Beyond. And she'll try out some of her own comedy material. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures, here on KQED.
That's ahead at 1 o'clock, followed by On the Media at 2.
After reporting about potential war crimes at sea, Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth lobbed shots at the messenger on this week's On the Media from WNYC.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Chloe Zhao was only the second woman to win the Oscar for Best Director, and that was for her 2020 film Nomadland, which starred Frances McDormand as an itinerant worker. Chloe Zhao is 43, and she's had a varied career ranging from low-budget contemporary westerns to making a Marvel film called Eternals, which is a supernatural epic with a colossal budget. Now Zhao has taken another distinct turn to Hamnet, a story about the creative life and the family life of William Shakespeare. Based on a novel by Maggie O'Farrell, Zhao's film is about Shakespeare as a young man grieving the loss of his only son. It stars Paul Mescal and Jesse Buckley. Chloe Zhao spoke with our staff writer Michael Shulman, who covers film and entertainment for The New Yorker.
So how did this book and how did this project make its way to you?
I was driving through New Mexico to Telluride Film Festival, and then that's when Amblin called me and told me about this project.
Amblin meaning?
Amblin, Spielberg's
production company.
And when they said it over the phone, you know, the reception, if you haven't been to the Four Corners, not great. And so it's in and out, and they're saying, you know, it's about Shakespeare's wife and the death of their son, and I just thought there's so many things in that sentence that I have no personal connection to. So I said no. And then a few hours later, I met Paul Mescal for the first time. I didn't know who he was because I had not seen normal people. His career has changed a lot in a short amount of time.
Yes.
But I sat next to the creek with him and I just felt something about him. You know, there's something about him. There's a simmering discomfort in him, like an animal, you know, like a steppenwolf, just want to burst out. And that's why he creates. So the energy was really strong. And he's talking about, I asked him, would you ever consider play young Shakespeare? And he said, wait, are you talking about Hamnet? I love the book so much. You have to read the book. It's not what you think it is. Please read the book.
So what about the book when you read it made you feel like you were the right person to do it? What were there details in the in the novel that really spoke to you?
When I read the book, I thought the internal landscape was so beautifully described. That usually I have to really get to know, say, Brady from the writer.
Mm-hmm.
I had to get to know him for such a long period of time. Would I understand his internal landscape? So then I can externalize it on screen. so the audience isn't just relying on him verbally, right? But Maggie already done that work for all the characters. So I thought, that's my blueprint. You know, and also there's a rhythm to the way she writes, has a heartbeat to it that is very similar to mine. I found out later that her favorite filmmaker is Wong Kar-wai, which is the person whose work that made me want to make films many, many years ago. So there was that similarity as well.
I mean, there's also an external landscape in the film that is so vivid. Mm-hmm. And you're a filmmaker who shoots the natural world beautifully. Anyone who's seen your first three features were all in or in part set in the American West and South Dakota specifically. Hamnet is set in Elizabethan England, and you shot in Wales and Herefordshire.
Yeah.
I'm curious about what you got from that very different kind of natural landscape as you were thinking about the film.
The natural world, the reason why it has been such a big part of every film I've done is because I can now, in my 40s, look back at my career and say the reason why that is because I have always had a deep fear of death. And I think that drives my creativity. And when you're afraid to die, you are actually not able to live fully. And I know that deep inside. At night, when the light goes off, you know, phone shuts off, I'm lying there, I know I'm not living my life fully. And it's because I'm so terrified. I don't feel safe in this world. And also my instinctual human self knows that when you go into nature, if you have a relationship with nature, then you develop a very embodied spirituality that is not relied on anyone else telling you, right? It's an embodied safety that you feel within oneness. And that you can only find in nature when you become one with your surroundings.
Mm-hmm.
That's all of our great prophets goes into nature to come back with the message for a reason. And so I just knew that's part of working on my own to get myself into nature. And the second part of to answer that question is that in my 30s, I was much more like a pioneer, like an going west, going into like finding treasures. I wanted to go as wide as possible, chasing horizon after horizon so I can come back with the treasures. The camera is insatiable. It wants to capture everything. And I want to move. I'm always on the move. And then in my 40s, after a midlife crisis, I realized that I can't keep running from myself. And in the forest, it's the opposite of the plains. And the forest is deeply feminine, and it makes you stay still. And when you stay still, you have nowhere to go but into the underworld and into yourself, where all your shadows are. So I knew in my 40s, this is the right place, right kind of nature for me to dive deep in. And when it comes to the forest in Wales, in terms of inspiration, I was, when I first visited that forest with my cinematographer, Lukas, we wanted to go to find a language for the film or just let the forest tell us what the film is about beyond what we read in the book. And I was in Kyiv right before that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was with somebody who was making a documentary about a strip of forest in the front line. And when I went to, when I left Kyiv and went to Wales, and it was this beautiful spring forest that we were in, me and Lukas was there, and I was getting some images and footage from the front line in Ukraine. And I will see these dark holes, black holes in the ground. And sometimes they're lime mines, holes. Sometimes they're dugouts. And then I walk around our forest and I will see these black holes that are natural made black holes. I just had such a big emotional reaction to it. I start crying. I sat next to the void, this black void, because it's coming for all of us.
Uh-huh.
And also in that void, the compost new life comes.
Mm.
In this hole here and the one in that front line, new life will come. And there's hope in Hamlet. He wrote, all living things must die, passing through nature to eternity. And to me, that eternity is love. And so then my Polish DP runs over and look at the hole and go, I understand this. We must film this hole. And then he filmed the hole. And we had Max Richter's Sleep album playing. And then he started lifting up at some point the tripod. And then it went up to the sky. And then it just started, went up and down. I was like, this is what the film is about.
Right.
So nature, we consider nature an HOD, a department head, is constantly working with us.
So one of your main characters is William Shakespeare.
I know.
The William Shakespeare, played beautifully by Paul Mescal. And, you know, this is not the witty, hyperverbal Shakespeare of Shakespeare in Love. Yeah. He's actually a man of pretty few words. He's brooding. He's frustrated. As you and Maggie were writing the screenplay, how did you approach just the challenge of writing lines for William Shakespeare?
I think the reason why the producers and also Maggie chose me is because I don't feel that way about William Shakespeare. I don't have the same reverence. I do have reverence intellectually, but I don't have the burden on my shoulders as many people in the West do. Maybe the same as I am with, you know, cowboys or Westerns, right? I watched only 2.5 Westerns when I made The Rider. So, but I watched more afterwards because I fell in love with it. And it's the same. I'm probably going to be doing more Shakespeare-related things after this. But I didn't come feeling that he's any different than a man who fell in love with a woman and couldn't quite express his feelings.
Mm.
So I never, the pressure is on the actors. It's on Paul, who does have a lot of reverence in the sense that not only what we put him through, not only playing William Shakespeare, but also telling the story of Orpheus Eurydice as William Shakespeare. So that, and to answer your question, he's very different than in the book. Actually, Maggie reminded me a couple of weeks ago when she was here. She's like, do you remember that? He's in the book, he's quite talkative.
Hmm.
He's expressive, you know, an actor. And I guess that was me. I guess I made a decision to change his character because I find a lot of artists, male artists, get into expressing themselves in their arts because they never felt safe to express their emotions in real life and in our society.
What are you looking at?
You.
Why?
I
thought you were a man of words, Master Tutor.
As a little boy, they're told to toughen up or... Mm. You know, there's no space for your emotions because mom is crying. You know, my sister is crying. So I was raised by a man like that. I've loved and beloved by a man like that my whole life. So it just became natural for me. And Paul as well was part of that decision as well, like watching him. There's him in this character as well. And I can only work that way because moment by moment, I need to feel love towards this character, right? And I need to feel like I understand him. And there's a part of me that is like him. I feel safe in my fantasy world on set. Then I can deal with emotional situations in life.
Mm-hmm.
So Paul was under a lot of pressure because we don't talk about who this character is. We start shooting and find him. So that's day three when we did the Orpheus scene, you know, the scene where he goes, I don't, talking to people is difficult for me. And then she said, tell me a story. We did that whole scene on day three and many, many takes. Usually I don't do that many takes just for him to find who is William Shakespeare speaking one of the greatest myths to a woman he fell in love with. That's very loaded.
Yes. And then at one point he actually bursts forth with the to be or not to be speech.
That's also pressure on Paul, yes.
So I know you went to school in England as a teenager. Were you taught Shakespeare there? Was that your first encounter with sort of his actual text?
Well, I didn't speak English. So when you don't speak English and you have Romeo and Juliet in front of you in the equivalence of a ninth grade, still, when I was on set of Hamlet, when Paul was delivering his speech, I only understand a third of it, technically, because I just don't understand what those words mean. But at the beginning, Paul has said to me, look, I can study it and translate every word and understand what it all means. But Paul said to me, listen, if Shakespeare is performed right, you don't have to understand what they're saying. You feel it in the body. The language is written like that. And so in a way, me and Lukasz, who also doesn't speak much English, we sat there and we watched Paul's performance. And in a way, we kind of embody Agnes, who doesn't quite understand everything, but we feel it. So in those days in the globe, I'm judging by me and Lukasz's physical reaction. We start crying or we go, oh, you know, our heart, like our throat is tight. Our stomach turns. Then we know it's the right take.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't even have to understand every word, which is really magical. It's making me think about Shakespeare completely different.
I mean, I think that's true for anyone watching Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. I believe you just wrapped directing the pilot of the Buffy the Vampire Slayer revival. Mm-hmm. So you're back working on a franchise with a very intense fandom.
Yeah, which I'm also one of them.
Sure, that helps. But I'm curious, as you move forward in your career, how do you see your relationship with the franchise-driven part of Hollywood? You know, I think from what I can tell, it's only getting harder and harder to make a movie that isn't based on something
IP.
Connected to some form of IP. And yet you've done both. You're continuing to do both. I mean, you could call Hamlet and
an IP.
William Shakespeare
yeah.
IP in some way, but, you know, it's a...
I thought about his sellability when I signed up. Both Maggie's book and him. So it's pretty strong IP we're dealing with here.
Right. So how do you see yourself fitting into the industry that is now so IP driven?
Why do you think that is?
Because people want safe bets. It's hard to make money.
Yeah.
On a film.
Yeah. You know, I just made an announcement, me and my producing partner, Nick Ganda. We teamed up with Kodansha, which is the oldest and one of the largest manga, publishing house in Japan. And they have everything from Akira to Ghost in the Shell to Attack on Titan, you know, their Sailor Moon. We just team up with them to launch Kodansha Studios, which means that we will be developing live action adaptations of their IP in-house before it goes to the studios.
Tell me more about manga.
Manga is quite different than Western comics, particularly American comics. Manga is heavily influenced by Shintoism, Japanese Shintoism. And if you don't know what that is believing that every object has a spirit, mm-hmm. right? Like this glass has a spirit within itself. There has been quite complicated relationship between studios licensing Japanese IP and it's particularly manga IP. And the adaptation process has been quite complicated for years and years and years now. So I've always dreamt to be a bridge between the East and the West and to be able to create a safe and nurturing garden in a way for international filmmakers, writer directors, and Japanese senseis, manga artists, authors to come together and to at early stage allow the artists to really see each other. Like, why did this artist create this story in Japan? You know, what is really the core of it? And then spiritually, emotionally, and then to find the right filmmaker and I can allow them to work together to develop the screenplay until the little, you know, the shoots of the plants are strong enough, and then we go to our studio partners. I think that's, I guess, one of my place in the IP world. And I think adapting from IP is beautiful. I started my writing career as a fan fiction writer.
Oh, really?
In China. A pretty well-known one, too. But you'll never know, because I will never share with you my pen name. But I don't mind. I think the word original is misunderstood in modern world, because origo means the source. It means old, the beginning. So original actually means going back to the source.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but our modern culture is so obsessed with new things. Must have new things. It's a very masculine dominated way of looking at the world. Must have new things all the time. But mm-hmm. nature, everything goes back to the source. So I don't mind working with IP. It's just how we do it needs to be, I think, could be healthier, more wholesome.
Mm.
Yeah.
The last thing I want to ask you about is you've described yourself as deeply neurodivergent. And you've talked about how you become overstimulated and kind of shut down. A director on a set has to deal with so much, so many people, departments, questions, images. So how does that challenge you on a movie set, and how does it help you on a movie set?
Good question. See, I didn't have my official diagnosis until this year. So in the past, I always wondered, maybe I'm just built wrong. Something is off with me. And I mean, going to like premieres or press days, you know, promoting the film is even harder because the amount of exposure, you know, going to an awards show or things like that. And so I feel a lot of shame around why can't I enjoy it? You know, like the people around me could be. And then once I have some language around it, it's very empowering. I go, okay, so the fact that I'm good at some things, right, is my sensitivity, my intuition, my ability to process information, my pattern recognizing skills. I can watch people and find patterns, and I can pretty much predict what they're going to do in a scene, right? All those things I understand is because my brain takes in so much more information than the person next to me. So I need time to process that information.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't process it and more coming in, then I could shut down and implode or just have massive, you know, meltdowns. So since then, and also a really strong perfume can give me a shutdown.
Really?
Yeah. If someone's wearing, if going through the airport, gotta go, you know, that's tough.
Okay. So you won't be working in smell-o-vision.
No. But I love, you know, anything with, that's natural, from the natural world is fine. It's the chemical in the perfume that is overwhelming, like cleaning products, air fresheners, things like that.
Well, you are very likely headed on the road to the Academy Awards again. So I hope that they are, that no one is wearing very strong perfume at them.
Well, that's lost cause. It's okay.
And congratulations on Hamnet.
Thank you.
It's a really beautiful movie.
Thank you.
The New Yorker's Michael Shulman, speaking with director Chloe Zhao. You can find Justin Chang's review of Hamnet at newyorker.com, and of course you can subscribe to The New Yorker there as well, newyorker.com. I'm David Remnick, and that's our show for this week. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell and Jared Paul. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
Stand by now for City Arts and Lectures. Next up, just 60 seconds from now, here on KQED News. We'll say good afternoon to Steve Herrera, checking a traffic problem in the East Bay. Steve?
Good afternoon, Michael. I see heavy traffic in Hayward, southbound the 880 off-ramp at Whipple Road. There's a crash on the shoulder of the off-ramp. Meanwhile, in South San Francisco, southbound 280 before Westboro Boulevard, somebody broke down in the center divide. And I see heavy traffic on the upper deck of the Bay Bridge from Grand Avenue to the metering lights. More slow and go from Treasure Island to 101. Steve Herrera for KQED.
Thank you, Steve. Support for KQED comes from Earth Justice, the nation's largest environmental law organization with more than 200 full-time lawyers who fight for a healthy environment. Learn more about how to get involved at earthjustice.org. Earth Justice, because the earth needs a good lawyer. And San Francisco International Airport sharing some holiday sparkle with travelers through SFO's